From the author of Putin's Wars comes an essential new military history of Russia from its beginnings to today.
Mark Galeotti, a leading scholar of Russian security affairs,
delivers a masterful history of how war and insecurity has driven Russia's destiny for centuries, including the disastrous invasion of Ukraine. This is the book you need to understand Putin's grip on power in the East, the war in Ukraine, and Russia's future on the global stage.
Forged in War is out now from Osprey Publishing. Order your copy wherever books are sold.
That's kind of conversation to your soul. That's conversation to your soul and the
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And we're very excited to welcome to the pod today my friend, Ben Fong. Ben is an associate teaching professor and honors faculty fellow at the Arizona State University, and he's also the associate director for the Center for Work and Demo Crazy. Ben, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And we invited you, of course, to talk about your book, Quick Fixes, Drugs in America from Prohibition to the 21st Century Binge. So I'm just going to start with a basic question. Are you on drugs now? No, just kidding. Why did you decide to write a book about drugs? Why are drugs important to understanding this thing we call capitalism?
Well, yes, to answer your first question, I'm on my favorite drug, which is coffee.
Oh yeah, true. We start with coffee. Good, 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 good. Wow, are you a natural podcaster?
It's great. So I wanted to take on the project because just anecdotally, it felt like everyone I knew was on drugs in some way or another. Part of that seemed to do with a change in the culture more generally. I think that mental illness has been more destigmatized over the years, and so people are more open about talking about the different psychoactive medications that they're on. But part of it's just a change in the perception of drugs more generally. I mean, I think the ideological motivations of the war on drugs are no longer convincing in the way that they were. And so it feels like people just have a lot of drugs on them at all times. I mean, I've been offered mushrooms by doctors and lawyers in the last year in a way that 2 decades ago, I just couldn't imagine something like that happening. So it feels like a different moment in American culture, and I looked into the numbers, and it's actually quite shocking. So Americans are, 4 to 5% of the world's population. We consume 80% of its opioids. We consume a little bit more than 80% of its amphetamines, its ADHD medications, and really across the board, especially in the 21st century, American drug use is sky high, and all the trends are going up. So I think your listeners are probably most familiar with the opioid crisis, things like that. But it's really across the board. I mean, marijuana, benzodiazepines, amphetamines, antidepressants, antipsychotics, everything's going up, with the notable exception of cocaine, which we could maybe talk about. The experts are not sure what's going on with cocaine. They knew it took a notable dive around 2005, and consumption hasn't shot up in the way that it was in like the 80s and 90s, for instance. But yeah, I mean, we're in this remarkable drug binge. There's no other society that's been as blitzed as Americans have been. It's a form of American prestige, if you will.
I mean, basically what I'm hearing here is that we won the Cold War and we get the drugs.
Yeah, it's actually not a bad thing. If after winning the Cold War, we were just fucked up the rest of our lives. But Ben, before we go into the book, could you talk a little bit about how you think this relates to contemporary capitalism and sort of the path that Fordist to neoliberal to what have you capitalism has shaped the consumption of drugs in the United States, both for practical reasons, just literal, the creation of novel markets, but also I imagine there's some psychological shit going on here.
Yeah, I think that the fact that American society is the capitalist society par excellence has a lot to do with it here. And there's a unique contradiction in the United States that I don't think that you get in other industrialized countries. I mean, I should say first that there's all sorts of contingent factors that play into American drug use. So, the fact that we got this uniquely large and powerful pharmaceutical industry. This was partially related to the growth of the security state that then can do things like direct-to-consumer advertising, which just doesn't exist in other countries. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff like that, which lead to high levels of American psychoactive drug use. But at root, I would say that the stressors of capitalist society are play a large role here. But there's this contradiction again in American society. On the one hand, we're fabulously wealthy and we have all the dreams of a society that's fabulously wealthy. On the other hand, I think that we're uniquely subject to the predations of capitalist society in a way that other industrialized countries aren't. So there aren't really strong countervailing forces to mitigate the effects of the market as there are in many European countries. And so if you fall to the bottom of American society, you can really fall to the bottom. And I mean that in a lot of different senses. I mean, you know, not just the fraying and often non-existent social safety net, but the fact that we don't have a history of socialist or labor parties, that we don't have, or that we have historically segmented and relatively weak unions. There's a lot of ways in which we're uniquely subject to the market. And I think in that kind of situation, we're prone to both excessive medication on the one hand, as well as excessive moralizing about other people's medication on the other.
So let's get into the book and let's start with the drug you're currently on that I am currently consuming. And that, of course, is coffee. So we could start, you know, with the origins of coffee. Famously, Habermas argued that, Habermas didn't argue. Fun fact, my boy Hans Speyer, who I wrote a book about, was the first person to argue that the Enlightenment and public opinion was formed in coffee houses. Mm. Habermas took that idea, and if I recall correctly, it's been some time, actually cited Speyer when he first made that argument. So it's actually my boy Hans Speyer. But Habermas argued that it was literal coffee houses and people coming together that created this thing called the public and public opinion. And there's also the argument that coffee was crucial, just like sugar was for the Industrial Revolution, by providing energy to workers and allowing them to exert more literal force on industry in order to create things. But feel free to take in whatever direction you'd like. But why is coffee important? And what does coffee say about this larger problem of drugs or solution of drugs?
Yeah, this is a great book by Wolfgang Schivelbusch called Tastes of Paradise, where he says that coffee does for us pharmacologically what the American dream does spiritually. And I think that that captures something of what coffee gives us. It's the most widely used drug in existence. It's the second most traded commodity after crude oil. I think I would argue that it's the only widely used psychoactive drug that has not been demonized in some consistent way. There was some campaign in the late 70s to warn us about the dangers of caffeinism. And actually in the DSM-3, the big psychiatric manual, caffeinism was added as a diagnosis. It was very quickly removed because I think nobody really wanted to believe it. But, you know, I mean, I think that it does, it acclimates us to capitalists, to the rhythms of capitalist society very well. And that's the reason why it hasn't been demonized ever.
What do you mean by that? What do you mean about it interacting with the rhythms of capitalist society? And maybe we can even talk about, because there's a fair bit of history in the coffee chapter about how the rise of coffee wound up shaping modern capitalist relations.
So if you look at the long history of human drug use, I'm talking about, you know, psychoactive substances in particular here, people have used drugs for a wide variety of things, oftentimes to acclimate to the rhythms of work. So cannabis and coca, chewing, have always been used by agricultural workers. You know, you get the use of psychedelics, various forms of psychedelics in religious rituals. Oftentimes there's all sorts of drugs just for sort of more moderate socializing. I think what's unique about the history of psychoactive drugs in the last 100, 150 years is that you see this process of slow instrumentalization of all drugs. And so everything sort of becomes about the things that get us up in the morning to do the tasks that we don't necessarily want to do, or the things that allow us to quickly unwind after work in order to be prepared for the next day of work. And drugs that don't fit into that dichotomy are generally unapproved substances. And of the drugs in the first category, drugs that get us up in the morning, there's really nothing quite like coffee. I mean, the military has long experimented with a wide variety of stimulants to complement and possibly replace amphetamines as a way of keeping us hyper alert. But, you know, the form of moderate jolt that can be widely accessible without causing social issues, there's really no replacement for coffee. I would argue, this is completely hypothetical, but I would argue that coca actually could serve that role if isolated cocaine were in a Schedule II substance and it wasn't such a target of the drug war. There are a wide variety of mild stimulants that could be on the market were it not for, you know, the history of the drug war in America. But coffee is pretty unique in that way. It is addictive, but it's not problematically addictive. And it gets us up in the morning.
Ben, I thought the layout of the book, like these first three chapters being coffee, tobacco, and alcohol was very interesting because it's almost like a work day, right? You have your coffee in the morning, you have your cigarette that gives you a reason to have a break from work darts in the day.
At lunch.
And then you drink at the end of the day to forget what you did. I have a couple of questions about this and kind of moving us into the next chapter, which is tobacco. But first of all, what do you think it says about the American experience that two of our legal drugs are coffee, which is supposed to help you perform at work and get up in the morning and do the things that you have to do, and then alcohol, which is supposed to help you kind of get past the stuff that you did all day and you know, kind of unwind at the end, and that we have this like you know, kind of bookend of drugs that we're taking to get through the workday.
I would go back to those instrumentalizing pressures in the last 150 years or so. Of those two categories of drugs, you know, that help us with arousal maintenance, essentially, right? The drugs that get us up in the morning, the drugs that help us unwind at night. Coffee and alcohol are really good for those things in a way that other drugs can be good in the right doses and monitored in the right way, but aren't quite as efficient. Now, I think that's changing in a lot of ways. Just the other day, actually a book talk for Quick Fixes, someone asked me about the possibility of opening up a nightclub where no alcohol was served, but they just served different psychedelic combinations, right? So you get microdosed psilocybin and 2CB in a drink.
So you get to hang out with the worst people in human history for the entire night.
But it's interesting that people are thinking along that lines. I mean, alcohol has organized social life in the West for so long. And I think that it is losing its grip in a way because there's a lot of other drugs on the market, because people have known, family members or friends who have struggled with alcoholism. So it's interesting that we're sort of moving a little bit past that moment where alcohol had such a central role in American life. But I think that, you know, again, there's a lot of factors that go into drug usage, and I'm including coffee and alcohol there. And they can be used relatively safely by lots of people. And I think that that's what accounts for the prominent role of coffee and alcohol. You know, I think every drug can be used safely. Fentanyl has long been used as a surgical anesthetic. It's just that, you know, it can be used very fatally as well as it is. So I would chalk it up to its relative safety, as well as the fact that it's very helpful in that task of arousal maintenance.
Thinking about alcohol and tobacco being, you know, the next chapter, and then alcohol the chapter after that, it's I think they provide an interesting case for talking about one of the concepts that you get into, which is the idea of licit versus illicit as distinct from legal versus illegal.
Yeah.
And you have alcohol, you have tobacco, which is legal, but at this point, I would argue largely illicit, right? Like people, smoking is bad. You know, we don't want smokers anywhere. We shunt them, you know, off to the little smoking area and keep them away from polite society. Alcohol, on the other hand, you have this period where, you know, back in Prohibition, where it was illegal, but very licit. Everybody, you know, most people were drinking, and this was a socially acceptable thing. So the experiences kind of highlight the distinction between what is legal and what is licit, I think, in interesting ways. Can you talk a little bit about those concepts?
Yeah. With the case of cigarettes, I think it's more segmented in the United States than we sometimes think. I was at a wedding recently in Philly and then one in Santa Barbara the next weekend. And everyone was smoking outside in Philly and no one was smoking in Santa Barbara. So even within the United States, cultures of smoking differ quite widely, I think, depending on where you are. I think that in the official mythology, the idea is that licit drugs are relatively safe and good for us and illicit drugs are dangerous and bad for us. And I think that that's what people would say if forced to give an answer to the question of what makes that distinction, but I don't think anyone actually believes that. The argument in the book is that what we consider licit are drugs that are taken by a respectable class of people, and drugs that we consider illicit are drugs that are taken by a class of disreputable people for whatever reason. And if you look at the history of psychoactive drugs, this schizoid distinction comes in again and again. So late 19th century, you've got Chinese opium smokers being demonized on the West Coast, while at the same time, you have people struggling with morphine addiction in the so-called doctor visiting classes, being treated like they have some kind of disease with which we should be sympathetic. And morphine is an isolate of opium. They're basically the same drug in under the right dosages. But you had completely different social judgments. And you see this thing repeat over and over again in the history of drug use. Benzodiazepines in the post-war period were legally sanctioned, whereas heroin, of course, was demonized. Perhaps the most stark contrast you get is between cocaine and crack come the 80s. It's really remarkable looking back at the way in which people talk about cocaine in the 1970s. Jimmy Carter's White House drug czar was talking about cocaine like it was perfectly benign, that it was the safest recreational drug in existence. And it was widespread, you know, and I think that part of it, part of the reason that it was seen as a respectable drug to do was because it was the professional classes that were largely doing it. Think back to that scene in Annie Hall where Alvy sneezes in the cocaine. He was surrounded by, you know, nice white professionals talking about their trip from California. Come the mid-80s, the profile of the drug completely changes. You know, you get the death of Len Bias and Don Rogers and the emergence of crack or rock cocaine. And the profile of the drug is completely different. It's now associated with the inner city poor black addict or drug dealer. And all of a sudden, it's this thing around which new, very punitive drug policy is formed. The basic argument there is that it completely has to do with the class of people taking the drugs. Now, often, this is directly racialized in ways that are legible to us, right? So Chinese and opium in the 19th century, Mexicans and marijuana in the 1910s, black people, largely black stevedores in New Orleans associated with cocaine in the 1910s. But in other ways, it's a little bit less legible. So, the target of the prohibition impulse at the turn of the century was largely immigrant Catholics. It was Irish and Italians. Today, to speak to your point, Derek, I think there's this image of the poor white working class person smoking cigarettes that is largely responsible for it no longer being culturally licit, despite the fact that, of course, cigarettes are legal. Now, part of the argument there is that there are institutional constraints from the legal and the illegal being the same thing as the licit and the illicit. There are different federal bureaucracies that govern drugs in those categories, the FDA and the DEA. And, you know, sometimes there's just that institutional inertia that prevents our current conceptions of drugs from being what's legal and not legal.
I have a quick question. Why do you think cigarettes have come back amongst certain numbers of millennials? I've seen various arguments that are like, they feel like there's no future, blah, blah, blah. But why is everyone in Philly smoking cigs?
I would guess because they were at a wedding and they didn't want to vape. But according to the numbers, as a whole, again, it's really class and context dependent. But as a whole, cigarette numbers have dropped pretty dramatically since their peak in the 70s, I think it was. But at the same time, you see this precipitous rise in the use of e-cigarettes and vapes. And in a way, they are safer. I mean, actually, this is sort of forgotten now. But when these devices first came on the market, they were advertised as harm reduction products. The whole idea was that you'd get the nicotine without the tar and the other dangerous stuff in cigarettes. And you know, so it was a safer product. As yet to be proven, you know, I think that we're still a decade or so away from the comprehensive, definitive studies that show that vaping is very bad for us. But in the meantime, you see this this rise in the use of these different products, and it's pretty remarkable. It's the old tobacco companies that are responsible for Juul and Vuse and all these other different products. They've just been, you know, very furtively switching out cigarettes for different devices for younger people, but retaining their market share essentially.
Ben, you get into alcohol in chapter 3, and I think, you know, here's where we really get into something that is like a blueprint for America's, at least the American government's relationship with a lot of other drugs that we would consider to be, you know, in the quote unquote hard drug category moving forward in a way that maybe coffee or cigarettes don't necessarily map as well. But can you talk about the American story with alcohol? And you know, the moral panic that emerges in the 19th century, which leads into prohibition, and then, you know, that experience and what you take from that, as you look at some of these other, the way the U.S. treats opiates, you know, cocaine and, you know, other drugs.
Yeah. So, you know, you might not get this sense from the commonly told history of prohibition. But the time of highest alcohol consumption in the United States was not before prohibition, but it was in the early 19th century. And this was at a time when, you know, there were just a lot of people on the frontier isolated for long periods of time. And so alcohol was a nice friend in those circumstances. But it was also one where, you know, in a lot of places you couldn't get reliably potable water. And so the bacteriological properties of beer and wine were just made them safer to drink. And so people drank a lot. It's generally, you know, people generally think that it was roughly, you know, 3 to 4 times what we drink per capita today. There's a history of the period called the Alcoholic Republic, early 19th century America. And it was thanks to a variety of things that had nothing to do with the prohibition impulse that that level of drinking slowly subsided. And so by the late 19th century, when you got the formation of a national temperance and prohibition movement, drinking in America had already gotten under control. I mean, it was roughly what it is today. So what had changed? Well, in, you know, after the Civil War, you get this rapid industrialization. You know, a lot of urbanization as well, and you know, working class neighborhoods where there are these drinking establishments, and you don't necessarily get more drinking, but you get a different kind of drinking. It's not drinking beer and wine throughout the day. It's now you get off factory work and you just get hammered at your local saloon. And especially, you know, because this inflamed the senses of middle class reformers, looking at you know, Irish and Italian immigrants drinking at their local saloon. And, you know, there's there's pictures of naked women on the walls, and they're not drinking beer and wine, they're drinking liquor. It just looked quite different, right? It was a different kind of drinking, not for sociability or for just getting through the day, but for visible escapism. And that really fueled the Women's Christian Temperance Union and the Anti-Saloon League, other kinds of prohibition organizations. And there were a lot of things that played into them. There was straightforward evangelical sentiment. There was that middle-class status anxiety. But I think at root, there was a desire to control the workforce. You know, I mean, if you're drunk working in a field, it's not the biggest deal, right? But if you're drunk and working on a line where other people might be in danger if you don't do the tasks that you're supposed to do, it looks quite different. And so the business class, you know, they were actually quite ambivalent about prohibition. They thought of it as a kind of unnecessary enthusiasm in a lot of ways. And of course, like once prohibition came, they had stockpiled a whole bunch of liquor and didn't really take it that seriously. But they did take seriously the idea that industrialization required a new kind of person. It required a person who was in control of their senses, that they were not a danger to themselves or other people on the line. And so they really allied with these middle-class reformers to push through prohibition in 1919, 1920. And during that time, you know, it was successful in one sense. Per capita alcohol consumption from 1920 to 1933 was the lowest it's been in American history. But all sorts of other kinds of social perversions emerged in that period as well. And, you know, we should have seen, we saw it quite clearly, the forms of social perversion and corruption that followed from the war on drugs. We saw it quite clearly in the war on alcohol. And that experiment ended in 1933. And since then, I think American drinking has been fairly moderate. I mean, there was a real concerted effort to bring beer and wine back into general sociability. There was a beer association, employers association, that put out a whole bunch of ads immediately after prohibition that pictured, you know, largely women serving beer to men around like a barbecue or whatnot. And since then, it, you know, American alcohol consumption, it's gone up and down here and there.
Original grill pilling.
Yeah.
And do you get that stupid reference?
Basically since 1933, that's what we've been doing.
We've been on the grill pill. So let's talk a little bit about this notion of commodity fetishism, because yeah. I really like how you introduced this concept. Maybe for those who aren't Marxist theorists among us, could you explain what commodity fetishism just is? Obviously, it's a complex term, but and how alcohol yeah. fits into this theoretical notion.
Yeah, commodity fetishism is a term that's introduced by Karl Marx, and I think the fourth section of the first chapter of Capital.
Yeah, you better fucking like know, or we're going to do this interview right now.
This is the thing that everyone's going to get mad about. And it's a confusing thing. It's a confusing thing to learn. It's a confusing thing to teach. It's not a very straightforward concept. I mean, I think that Marx takes the concept from discussions of religion and superstition at the time. And the idea being that some kind of sacred, there's some kind of spiritual investment in the commodities that we can't really account for, and that they organize social relations in new ways once you reach a certain point in the development of capitalism. There's lots of different ways I've heard it explained. But the thing that I try to draw out in the alcohol chapter is to show that to chart a certain decline in sociability and the organization of sociability around commodities. And so, again, if you go back to the early 19th century, well, how did people drink? It was largely at taverns. And so, you know, taverns were organized spatially quite different from saloons or bars. There was like the bar where you walk to, you get a drink, you're spacing the bar or the bartender. It was just tables, right? It was tables where you could order food, where there was just general sociability. And there was also an expectation that people bought drinks for one another and reciprocated. This led to some really funny sort of portraits of drinking at the time. it was sort of, you know, the excesses of frat house life writ large in American society. There was a real expectation that if you walked into a tavern and weren't buying drinks for people and reciprocating and accepting drinks that were given to you, then you weren't sociable. And you could say that that's a kind of sociability that I don't want to participate in, but it did evidence strong social ties, a desire for social obligation in a way that you don't get today. And so prohibition, you could say, was really an attack, a sort of middle-class anxiety-fueled attack on that primary sociability and social obligations.
Need parts now? O'ReillyAuto.com offers in-store pickup, same-day home delivery, or next-day home shipping. Get more parts your way at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
If you're a maintenance supervisor for a commercial property, you've had to deal with everything from leaky faucets to flickering light bulbs. But nothing's worse than that ancient boiler that's lived in the building since the day it was built, 50 years ago. It's enough to make anyone lose their cool. That's where Grainger comes in. With industrial-grade products and dependable fast delivery, Grainger can help with any challenge, from worn-out components to everyday necessities. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a maintenance supervisor for a commercial property, you've had to deal with everything from leaky faucets to flickering light bulbs. But nothing's worse than that ancient boiler that's lived in the building since the day it was built, 50 years ago. It's enough to make anyone lose their cool. That's where Grainger comes in. With industrial-grade products and dependable fast delivery, Grainger can help with any challenge, from worn-out components to everyday necessities. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
And that's broken apart during Prohibition. And in the aftermath, with the emergence of the moderate drinking culture that's basically been present since the post-war period, definitely, but sort of right after Prohibition, I would argue, sociability is organized differently. And so when people go out, it's largely to buy drinks and to serve the commodity. And so sociability has been reorganized. It used to be the case that alcohol helped us be social, and now we are social in the service of commodity consumption. And I think that that transition helpfully illustrates something that Marx was after, which is that the commodity really becomes an organizer of social relations.
Very interesting. So it's almost a object-oriented ontology.
And there's also, you know, I mean, I would argue that social ties have become weaker as well. I mean, I can walk in, if I'm going out with friends, I can walk into a bar and say, if someone offers me a drink, I can say, I don't want that. Or I'm going to get something different. Or I don't feel like drinking. Or I don't drink. There's all sorts of preferences that I can articulate at that moment. And in one sense, that's great, right? That's evidence that I'm free to do things in society that I maybe wasn't 200 years ago. On the other hand, that evidence is the fact that there's some lack of social obligation, I would say, in the way that there used to be.
Ben, I just want to say that's like the third or fourth time you've mentioned having friends. Just stop the bragging and cool it a little bit, okay?
No, I mostly just hang out at home and watch YouTube videos.
Let's talk about opiates. And I think in terms of this drug, it might be useful to talk about in particular the way that the history of the security services and the security state intersects with opium. And you could start in sort of the orientalizing aspect of it, but I'd really love for you to focus on this more recent security imbrication, as we say in academia.
Yeah, I think that, so in the opiates chapter of the book, that's really where I talk about the rise of both global and domestic drug policy, drug prohibition, you know, sort of the paradigm of what some people have called punitive prohibition. And it was really the United States that pushed it from the very beginning. So we passed the Harrison Act in 1914. This was the first national piece of policy that actually made different classes of drugs illegal. At first, it was just heroin and cocaine. Eventually, that was expanded. There was a real resistance to doing this. I mean, even people who thought that it was a problem were very reticent to legislate on what they considered to be moral individual issues of individual choice. And so it was a kind of paradigm shift that went along with prohibition as well. The idea that there should be some form of social coercion in the interest of the social good, that was a real new thing. And it was not just something that was implemented in America. The same reformers that were pushing the Harrison Act and associated pieces of legislation, they were also pushing international drug controls around both the same drugs, largely heroin and cocaine. And cocaine had just been sort of added to the list of things that were on the list of people's radar at the time very recently. It was really heroin that was the issue, heroin and associated opiates. In the book, so this, the subtitle to the opiates chapter is Civilizing the Orient. Bishop Charles Brent, who oversaw the big international drug control conferences in the 1900s and 1910s, he said that our mission is to bring civilization to the Orient. Obviously a problematic statement, but I think that there's something there that speaks to the desire for controlling opiates more generally. You know, like, what was the image of the Chinese coolie on the West Coast in the late 19th century? It was an effeminate, non-white, foreign agent that was causing us to be lazy and somehow sapping the spirit of America. Writ large, I think that that's sort of the image of the opiate user in general, right? That it like sort of saps your spirit in a way that it makes you feminine or unmasculine or otherwise not suited to the rigors of capitalist society. That's really been the reason that opiates have been targeted for so long. Now, I think that that continues throughout, and it's pretty remarkable that anytime there's an opiate scare, and this is through fentanyl to the present and its connection with China, it always has this connotation of orientalizing the people who use them. But to get to your other question, just about the rise of the American security state when we became the global hegemon moving out of like the Second World War. This is a related history, but I would say it's particular to the rise of certain institutions, in particular the CIA, formed in 1947 from the remnants of the OSS. And there's a few different ways in which this is important. One, Harry Anslinger, who was the head of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics from 1930 to 1962, he was good buddies with OSS guys and thought of himself as very much in line with the mission of the CIA. I would argue even more than his own agency, the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. He actively suppressed the reports of his own agents in order to go along with CIA dictates. During the war, Anslinger was stockpiling all kinds of drugs. And he understood, I think rightly, that this was a security issue, that like if you could not distribute antibiotics and opiates and other painkillers during wartime, this is a big issue. And so he was stockpiling those drugs, but also all kinds of things. And that's one of the reasons why in the aftermath of the Second World War, there was a real desire to control international drug flows and to stockpile all kinds of drugs that then helped the nascent pharmaceutical industry become the behemoth that it is. So that's one part of the story, the more legal or licit side of the story. The other side of the story is that the CIA, again, basically from its inception, had this strategy that was repeated over and over again. And you could argue, one could argue that the founding case, the case of this, was the French Connection, the infamous French Connection, where they were, I'm probably going to get the details of this wrong as well, but I think where they were funding the Corsican Mafia to disrupt communist influence at the ports, both in Italy and in France. Ignoring the fact that the Corsicans were trafficking heroin from Turkey through Marseille into the United States and Canada. That was the French connection, right? And this basic model of funding anti-communists and letting them run drugs is repeated in a lot of places. They do it with the Kuomintang in exile in Southeast Asia. They do it with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. They do it with the Contras in Nicaragua. It's just the same playbook over and over again
in the last 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's a common playbook, and it's just repeated itself over and over again. In some cases, they were just ignoring what their quote unquote allies were doing. In other cases, they were active players. Like they had a front airline in Southeast Asia, Air America, that was running miscellaneous cargo for various groups. So they, in some cases, they went beyond just ignoring the fact to sort of fund anti-communist insurgencies. In some cases, they were actual players in drug distribution. It's a pretty remarkable story. I mean, there's a lot of different ways in which the CIA is implicated in the history of drugs. There's the MK Ultra experiments as well, which we could talk about. But on both sides, they were very interested in controlling international drug flows in the licit legal market, which propped up the pharmaceutical industry. But they also had a real heavy hand in really creating different drug markets through this basic strategy of funding anti-communist groups by allowing them to sell drugs.
And so also the idea was that they would use that money to support it. But then also I imagine there were like circulations that were invested in various products and projects by the CIA. I can't imagine they didn't take a piece.
That's a good question.
That would not be declassified, yeah, but like, right. Has there been any, it would be through interviews, yeah, at best.
No, that's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I haven't heard anything about it either.
But that's, I just can't imagine that it's not
right.
So, Ben, building off of what you were talking about the CIA, I mean, you mentioned MK Ultra. Let's talk about MK Ultra and maybe kind of position it as a microcosm of the way the U.S. has approached psychedelics effectively. Especially in the in the 20th century, and just their kind of transition to what is, was very counterculture and now is almost becoming, I wouldn't quite say licit, but is certainly much more kind of openly talked about for its beneficial, their beneficial capabilities.
For sure. I mean, I would argue, to go back to that distinction between licit and legal, most of the psychedelics are still Schedule I substances, which in the eyes of the federal government are drugs with no medical usage whatsoever and are very, very dangerous. So LSD, psilocybin, MDMA. And yet at the same time, I would argue that these are very, that they're in the realm of the licit now. And it's projected that MDMA is going to receive FDA approval in like third quarter 2024 or something like that for the treatment of PTSD. So we are on the cusp of seeing these drugs finally enter the legal realm. And I don't make any predictions other than this in the book, but it does feel like the psychedelic stuff is going to take off real quick. Like in the next decade or so, it's just going to be everywhere. But to go back to MK Ultra, so as you said, I think that psychedelics are most associated with 1960s counterculture, new left kind of thing. But the way in which psychedelics entered American society was really through the CIA. John Lennon is famous for having thanked the CIA for the countercultural moment. And he was right. He was right. It was largely CIA stores that escaped elite hands and sort of entered American society. So, to go back a little bit, there was the belief in the intelligence services that the communists had discovered some ways of controlling people's minds. And this was particularly prominent in a lot of the coverage of the Korean War, where you saw some soldiers become quite critical of American policy. And there were a bunch of stories at the time that the Koreans or the Chinese or whoever had figured out ways of brainwashing American soldiers. There are a lot of stories about communist brainwashing, that they had invented some kind of technology to control people's minds, to have what was described at the time as master-slave controls over other people's minds. And the CIA heard this. They're like, well, we got to figure this out. And so one of the projects that they funded to do this was MKUltra. It was Project Artichoke and then Project Bluebird. There were other projects that preceded it, but it really took off with MKUltra. And this was under the direction of a guy named Sidney Gottlieb, with the help of Alan Dulles and other people. And what they did in MKUltra was use a variety of drugs, but primarily LSD, to try to break people's minds and to rebuild them. And there are, there's some iterations of this. They funded all sorts of groups, but there's some iterations of this that were kind of funny to talk about. So they ran a brothel in San Francisco where they would unknowingly dose clients with LSD to try to figure out how you use the art of seduction in combination with drugs to get people to talk about things they didn't want to talk about. Horrifying, no doubt, in some circumstances, but kind of like funny to discuss in another way. There are some projects that they funded that were just straightforward torture programs. I mean, some of the worst things that human beings have done to other human beings. I mean, in large part because of Paperclip, they had brought over Germans and Japanese scientists who told them about their own biological experiments, and they sort of learned from that. But just did awful, unrepeatable things to people, and had funded a bunch of psychiatric institutes. And so, people with morning sickness or like anxiety about the birth of their child would go in and see a psychiatrist, and they would come out just, nonverbal. And people were like, well, what happened in there? And it was a secret for a long time, but it was because of these different MKUltra investments that kind of stuff was happening. I mean, it's the most elaborate, to my knowledge, torture program that the United States government has run. It was elaborate. It was unrestrained, and it went on for a really long time. But that really was because of MKUltra that you got the seepage of certain quantities of LSD into the broader population. I mean, I'm not sure whether this is just a funny anecdote or whether it's true, but it's said that Eli Lilly, who was commissioned to produce LSD for the CIA, that they got a decimal point wrong in the order. And so they ended up producing tons, like literal tons of LSD instead of the amount that they were supposed to produce. There's just a wild amount of LSD out there. And as a result, all of these shady characters had, just jars of LSD at home that they were given to people like Tim Leary. And so in a lot of ways, the CIA really fueled the American counterculture in the 60s.
So Ben, luckily you've agreed under duress. We use some unorthodox methods to get you to agree to come back for another episode. So why don't we end this one?
CIA derived.
I will neither confirm nor deny that
implementations. Yeah.
But could we talk a little bit about the present opioid quote unquote crisis? Not to say it's not a crisis, but crises are social factors, not objective ones. So what is the opioid crisis? And again, how does it relate to this quick fixes notion that you articulate in the book?
Yeah, there's a specific history of the opioid crisis that we ought to get into. And that has to do with a revolution in our understanding of pain treatment in America. In the 50s, 60s, people knew about opiates. They had long been part of, American pharmacology. But there was a general perception that they were addictive and dangerous. And so it was very, very difficult to get doctors to prescribe opiates, despite the fact that they could technically do so. And a variety of things fed into a real transformation in the understanding of how pain ought to be treated. One of these was the introduction of new subdisciplines. So palliative care, for instance, this was a new discipline, I think in the 70s. And the idea that, you know, we would be treating end of life issues, but then eventually issues of chronic pain as well. And that's a pretty loose conceptual vehicle, this idea that someone would be chronically in pain. There were also the introduction of new methods for assessing pain. So there's the introduction of the Wong-Baker faces scale. So if anyone's been to the doctor and they've seen faces on an intake form, so from very sad to very happy, and you like circle the face like I'm a number 4 in pain or something like that. That had to be introduced, and when it was part of a patient's chart. And there were legal reasons why doctors now wanted to treat pain more seriously because of the introduction of these different methods. There were also companies like Purdue Pharma, which I'm sure your listeners have heard of, who were who were pushing their new products like OxyContin, which is just straight oxycodone, as virtually non-addicting. So oxycodone is, you know, the functional equivalent of heroin. But they had all these doctors come out and say that it was virtually not addicting, and that any signs of addiction that you might see in patients were actually forms of pseudo-addiction. It was a sign that you weren't treating the pain enough, and so you had to give more OxyContin. You know, I won't get into the practices of Purdue Pharma. I think that they're, you know, widely documented. There's a bunch of Netflix series about them and whatnot. I mean, they did all sorts of things to really push OxyContin on the population. What's less talked about is the fact that basically every other pharmaceutical company followed suit. Like once they saw that Purdue Pharma was making money hand over fist, they came out with their own opiate products. And so it wasn't just OxyContin. There were a lot of different, you know, very big pharmaceutical companies involved in the opioid crisis, era, pushing the opioid crisis. The historian Kathleen Friedel calls it the pharma cartel, that we use the word cartel very inaccurately a lot of the time. But in the case of the pharmaceutical industry, I think it's legitimate to speak of a cartel working together to push opioids on the population.
Just for the profit motive. So just take a step back. Is it just profits? That's it.
I mean, in the case of Purdue, it was just profits. The Sacklers, the Sackler family, which owned and ran Purdue Pharma for a long time, they were marketing geniuses in one sense. Arthur Sackler had actually gotten his start marketing Valium and Librium, the two biggest, the sort of blockbuster benzodiazepines of the 1970s and 80s. And so they're very smart people. They're good at marketing and advertising. And you know, once Purdue Pharma's profits took off, that's when the other pharmaceutical companies got in the game. Pretty quickly, people sort of realized what was going on. Purdue in particular targeted doctors that were, to say the very least, unethical in their practices, doctors who were, you know, most of the time themselves addicted to their products, and were opening what were called pill mills, basically places where people could come, have 5-minute meetings, and be prescribed, you know, a high dose OxyContin. And these pill mills were opened in places of the country that were largely devoid of other, you know, healthcare apparatuses. And so I think the story of the genesis of the opioid crisis is largely one of, you know, the dysfunction of our healthcare system more generally, that it filled in where there might be more adequate services. But it did eventually come to an end. A lot of the pill mills were shuttered. And in the wake of that, the journalist Sam Quinones, I think, has most helpfully charted this. There were new different heroin distribution operations, mainly out of a small region of Mexico, that began, you know, filling in the gaps, right? So they would come to America with relatively small amounts of heroin and go to markets where the pill mills had just shuttered, again, places that non-urban areas that didn't have great healthcare infrastructure, and basically filled in where the pill mills left off. And so they avoided, you know, the saturated markets on the East Coast, and they went to places like Columbus, Ohio. And, you know, it was a very quiet business. They were not very violent. It was just, you know, efficient transactions of very strong heroin. But, you know, that was that largely filled in for the lack of legal opioids. And so this was a time where the opioid crisis was really spiking. It's come down some in the meantime. But we're still, you know, since 2021, we are over 100,000 overdose deaths a year in America. And that has continued since 2021.
So what does this suggest to you? This will be the final question. What does this suggest to you about drugs in 2024 America? Is there any sort of way that this reflects larger structures, or is this just a grim story well told in quick fixes?
Yeah, I mean, so like I said, I'm pretty reticent to make predictions in the book, insofar as we don't know what comes after neoliberalism. It's unclear what's going to happen in drug history. I think that if you look at drug trends over time, they really do reflect broader social changes. And insofar as we don't know what's coming next exactly, we know that the neoliberal period is ending, but you know, what comes after it, a lot of people have some tentative predictions, but we don't really know. I have a difficult time speculating. I would have said for a long time that the trends in decriminalization and harm reduction are only going to grow more prominent. I'm not sure that's the case now. In Oregon, they passed a ballot measure in 2020 that decriminalized all drugs, and the legislature recently recriminalized those drugs because the experiment has gone so poorly in the eyes of many. And it doesn't seem like the decriminalization movement is really going to recover. So it's really interesting. I mean, in the same way that no one knows what comes after the neoliberal period, the war on drugs, everyone recognizes, has been an absolute failure. You see this recognition on the left, of course, but also now on the right increasingly, that you know, the ideological motivation there has just been, you know, just completely gone. But at the same time, nothing's really replacing it. You would expect decriminalization and legalization to proceed apace, but there's real reticence around that as well. Again, I would say that what we're going to see now and for the foreseeable future is just the psychedelics market really blow up and take over the market from the SSRIs, the SRNIs, and become normalized in American
culture.
So, Ben,
I have a question about this because I've heard that a lot, and I'm actually a bit skeptical, and I'll explain why. Just psychedelics, from everything that I know, are just a much more intense experience, right? Yeah. So, like, SSRIs are not psychotropic in the same way. They do alter your consciousness, as you have shown, but it's not in that like period of intensity, right? And marijuana and alcohol and cocaine and other drugs are also similarly limited in time, or at least with alcohol, obviously you could get like blitzed, but it's over time, right? So there's this time dimension here that I think it makes it difficult somewhat for me to imagine that true psychedelia is going to explode. But tell me if you think I'm missing something or what I'm not quite getting.
So I mean, we'd have to get more into the SSRIs and other antidepressants. I think it's largely recognized, even within psychiatry, that these are failed experiments, or at least that the promises of the blockbuster antidepressants were way overblown. And that most of the times in various clinical trials, you see placebo drugs working in the same way as SSRIs. And it's for that reason and many others that I think the discipline of psychiatry is really broken. It's seen as in crisis from the outside, but even within medical circles, it's seen as something that it hasn't progressed in 70 years. And that within the medical field, I think is in a degree of disrepute. In that state, I can't see psychiatrists as anything but wanting something to renew their discipline. And that's certainly how the big psychedelic startups are targeting their development. So, you know, Compass Pathways, MindMed, Johnson & Johnson to a lesser degree, they're thinking of their developments as something that is going to renew the field of psychiatry. And in so much as that's the case, yes, it's a very different model, but there's So this is maybe going to get us a bit far afield, but there's lots of different models for the deployment of psychedelics today. There are some, I would say the prominent ones, where it's what you're talking about, right? It's a high dose experience. You do it a few times in the presence of like a licensed facilitator and you have an integration session, and that's essentially the model. There are some companies that are trying to develop psychedelics where there are no subjective effects, but they do the same kind of neuroplasticity stuff that psychedelics do, in which case it seems sort of very ripe to be replacing SSRIs. There's also a real investment in non-psychotherapeutic, non-facilitated, microdosed use of psychedelics as well, in the case of psilocybin in particular. And the legal iterations of psilocybin usage as in Oregon are really trying to figure this out. Like, how do you not just do these high dose experiences for some people who want them, but how do you also open up the market for microdosed psilocybin? In those ways, there's all sorts of ways for the psychedelics market to develop. And just given the fact that so many very powerful players are wanting to renew the discipline of psychiatry, I can't help but see it as impacting that market.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And this probably relates to things like the replication crisis that we could talk about elsewhere. But Ben, thank you so much for joining us. And I genuinely look forward to having you back soon. Derek is a bit, cool. But I'm excited.
I'm sorry. I'm high, so I don't... my emotional... state is unclear.
Thank you all and see you again soon. Bye.
If you're a maintenance supervisor for a commercial property, you've had to deal with everything from leaky faucets to flickering light bulbs. But nothing's worse than that ancient boiler that's lived in the building since the day it was built, 50 years ago. It's enough to make anyone lose their cool. That's where Grainger comes in. With industrial-grade products and dependable fast delivery, Grainger can help with any challenge, from worn-out components to everyday necessities. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Need parts now? O'ReillyAuto.com offers in-store pickup, same-day home delivery, or next-day home shipping. Get more parts your way at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
O'Reilly.